The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. I'm your host, Brett King, and we're going to be talking all things sustainable in terms of banking today and looking at some great data. Also, we're going to do a crossover to Ukraine and see how customers of banks and banks are coping with the challenges going on there now. What is an economy in this sort of state? What happens to day-to-day banking when you have issues like that? That's going to be happening later in the show. But before we get started, I wanted to do a quick shout out to Josh and Shamir at Simple today. You guys may have seen that they launched Simple 2.0, so they've done a big major release today for Simple. It wasn't without a few little challenges. They had some challenges as they relaunched, but they've done a big relaunch. It looks pretty impressive. So big shout out to Josh and Shamir. Looks like it was painful, guys, but well done on getting through the process and the new product that you guys have launched. So check it out, simple.com. Okay, now our guest this week is a well-known author in the field of sustainability, Andrew Winston. Andrew, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about how you got into your area, which is the area of sustainability, green, and so forth. And for those that don't know you, give us a little bit of an introduction to your sphere of expertise.
Sure. Yeah. So I spent, probably the first half of my career in business, in strategy and marketing and business development jobs, working for Boston Consulting Group and then in media companies doing kind of strategy roles. I didn't have really an environmental background at all or, working on sustainability. But I hit this point in my career where I wanted to kind of marry my background and my training with just kind of a passion or an interest in kind of what was going on in the world. And I, took a look at kind of the big picture issues and thought, the way we're managing the economy, the way we use capitalism has got some deep flaws. And we were, I think, facing some serious constraints on the growth of the economy and on prosperity for all of humanity. And I decided to try to go back to school and kind of get some more education in green stuff and got a degree in environmental management. And I already had an MBA, so I kind of put those two together and I started doing some research, worked with a professor I met in grad school, and I did 3 years of research writing this book, Green to Gold. And it was all about how companies manage the pressures they're under and how they try to reduce their impacts, save money, innovate, drive new thinking into the organization. And that was about 8 years ago, and I've spent the better part of a decade kind of building on that and working with companies closely. So I sit on sustainability advisory boards with some large companies, Fortune 200. I do consulting. I do a lot of speaking and a lot of writing, and I have a new book out called The Big Pivot, which we can talk about today, I think, about kind of where we
absolutely
need to go now.
Absolutely. So, one of the areas where, there's a bit of contention within banking is how do you make banking sustainable and green? But I've got a big theory around this is, we could start with getting rid of application forms and just going purely digital. But, for organizations that are not producers of sort of hard products and so forth, you know, more virtual. What are some of the issues in terms of sustainability and being, you know, environmentally aware and right. And aware of, you know, these other aspects?
Well, I think, you know, there's always, in some sense, this misunderstanding that being green is just about, you know, how much carbon are you producing or what's your footprint. And banks can claim, like service businesses, that they don't have a deep footprint. They're not a manufacturing industry. But in reality, you know, for a financial institution, it's about their business and where is their money going. So there's been plenty of attention on, you know, greening buildings, making them more efficient, you know, having people operate in a more efficient way. As you said, going digital can help, reducing paper, you know, two-sided printing, all those kinds of things around the office. But that's a really minor part of the footprint of a financial institution, right? It's about where are they investing, and how are they putting a value on their investments? How are they thinking about risk? How are they thinking about what's material for the businesses that they invest in or give money to? And so there's been a lot of pressure over the years on banks about, you know, are they funding fossil fuels? How are they doing it? Are they thinking about the risk to those investments as we start to move away from, you know, carbon-intensive fuels? And are they understanding those risks as they invest in, say, you know, coal around the world? And I think you see banks starting to take a much kind of broader, deeper view of, you know, kind of traveling the world, talking to companies of all stripes about how they were handling the kind of pressure to go green and how they were managing their impacts.
And tell me about the premise behind the new book, The Big Pivot.
Yeah, well, The Big Pivot kind of takes off from, you know, where my other work left off in a lot of ways and says, okay, so, you know, all my early work was really about it's good to go green, it saves money, it drives innovation, and that's all still true. But the big pivot is about the fact that we're facing some really unusually large challenges now, and that they're getting very, very pressing and very expensive. And the two that I focus on primarily are climate change and extreme weather, you know, which are making for a very volatile business environment. And then tied with that, the rise of resource prices, commodity prices, the kind of rising demand around the world for resources. And when you put these two together, it is a volatile situation. It's a fast-changing world. And there's this layer of kind of transparency around everything companies do now. It's kind of the third force that I focus on. And the premise is that if you believe these challenges are as big as they are, then the way business operates, and that's not just manufacturing and consumer products, but banks and finance as well, it needs to flip in a very profound way from focusing on just short-term earnings and then getting to these big shared challenges, you know, when the hurdle rate looks exactly right or when there's enough pressure or when they feel like it, and flip that and say we need to operate in a way that manages these challenges together, and then work back and say, how do we do that most profitably? How do we use competition and how do we use capitalism and markets to do it most profitably? And that's a kind of fundamental shift. And so the big pivot lays out, you know, a bunch of strategies for companies to adopt, some of which are pretty radical for them to embrace.
Yeah, I'm very interested in sort of talking about the what's happened with solar and renewables and so forth in places like Germany and Iceland, but I think we might have to get to that after the break. Where are you based, Andrew? Just for people.
Yeah, I live in the New York area. I live in Greenwich, yep. Connecticut. So I'm actually in kind of hedge fund finance capital of the world.
Absolutely,
a lot of people in the finance realm.
Great. All right. Well, listen, I just want to do a quick cross to Liz Lumley. Liz is our correspondent in the UK. So bear with us, Andrew, and then we'll come back to you after the break and continue the discussion.
Sure.
So let's now cross to Liz Lumley, our correspondent in London. Liz is with Finextra. She's an editor there at Finextra. If you guys don't know Finextra, you can check it out, finextra.com. It's definitely one of the mainstream financial newspapers online, or financial, I don't know what you call it, Liz, but, and she's going to, what did you call it?
Fintech.
You know, hotspots online. And Liz is going to talk to us about what's happening in the Silicon Roundabout over the pond in London. So Liz, give us an update.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, sort of, as you mentioned, Finextra is one of the premier news sites for financial technology, or fintech for short. And we've been around for a number of years, but it seems in the past year and a half, 2 years, financial technology has really exploded and become having a bit of a moment. And London is a huge center, if not in Europe and possibly globally. We've written a number of stories about whether New York or London is the center for financial technology. I think as an American, I can safely say I think London might have the edge, if not some of the tech.
Oh, we should have a New York versus London show soon. I can see that coming.
But I mean, probably recently, the reason why, if your audience doesn't know why it's called Silicon Roundabout, there's a huge roundabout or rotary, if any of you are from New England, which is located near Old Street in East London, outside the city, and a number of tech companies have risen up in this area over the past few years, and quite a few of them are in the financial space. And this is really being pushed by the government to get more entrepreneurship, to get more startups, more companies in this space. And there have been a lot, about a year and a half ago, a group called Level 39 opened up in Canary Wharf. On the 39th floor of One Canada Square, and they've been having a lot of events, and it's become kind of the meeting place for people in this fintech space.
Are they an incubator or a design house, or what are they?
They're not really. I guess they're an accelerator. They're not right. Sort of like a boot camp type place, or I know every bank has their own accelerator now. They give office space to small companies that need it. And of course, on Canary Wharf, there are a lot of where banks have their European headquarters, so they're very close to the banking community, because a lot of these startups, that's kind of one of their top priorities, that's to sell into the big bad banks. So they like being very close. And so they get office space, they get access to mentors, and then once they start growing and get bigger, they get moved up to level 42. Or the high growth accelerator space, and then they grow up and onwards and bigger and hopefully succeed.
Great. So that's at One Canada Square, level 39.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of events that have happened there. And so basically over the past couple of weeks, there was a huge launch at level 39 with some of the people that are involved with level 39, namely a woman named Claire Cockerton. And she's going to head up a new group called Innovate Finance. So they had a huge launch, which was introduced by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne. It's kind of going to set itself up as a lobby group, which is going to promote fintech businesses in the UK and globally. So they've launched with about 53 companies and a number of banks. So everything from a small sort of prepaid young person card called Osper, and IBM's involved, number of other banks like Lloyds, which is one of the big four UK banks, is involved. So that launched about a week and a half ago. So they're really sort of have the backing of the UK government to promote fintech businesses in this region.
Was this also where the Chancellor talked about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin, yes. This is, I think, you know, there's been a lot of debate about what he actually meant about Bitcoin. Yes, whether it's going to be legal or whether it's even legal tender at all. I think governments sort of need to say something about Bitcoin, because it's kind of conspicuous if they don't. I think the government is just sort of looking at it from a regulatory point of view.
Yeah.
They'll probably produce some lovely paper that's maybe meaningless very soon.
No.
I think that's what he's doing. I mean, I think what's kind of more interesting, he said something else that wasn't really picked up on as much as the Bitcoin, because, of course, Bitcoin is a big buzzword. But I've heard from a number of people the sort of mainstreaming of peer-to-peer lending, and it's becoming kind of a thing that he mentioned that the government's really going to push support for peer-to-peer lending. And I've heard from a number of analysts in Europe that a lot of sort of big traditional vendors are probably going to get into the peer-to-peer lending arena. Maybe companies, I don't know this for sure, but he mentioned companies like Mises and SunGard, some of those big old players.
That makes sense.
So I think peer-to-peer lending is going to become much more not alternative finance.
Sort of like mainstream. And Zopa, of course, has done very well in the UK. Well, so thanks, Liz. Thanks for joining us. I definitely want to get you back on and get some more updates for us. So please, will you join us again on a future show as our correspondent?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Fantastic. Liz Lumley from Finextra. Check out finextra.com. Right now it's time for a break. We'll be right back with Breaking Banks in a moment.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's kony.com/BK.
Hey, honey, where are we gonna eat tonight?
I don't know. Check Yelp for some place with good reviews.
Okay. Ooh, this place called Gabriel's looks nice. Authentic Italian cuisine sound good to you?
Sure, why not? Is it far?
Hold on, I'm checking. Looks pretty close, actually.
Let's just Uber it, then.
Chicken parm sounds great, but I've been trying to watch my weight.
I thought Lose It said you were on track to lose 5 pounds. I don't think one chicken parm is gonna hurt you. Anyway, after dinner, I thought we'd check out that new jazz club you've been wanting to go to.
Oh, I have a feeling that's far beyond our budget.
Actually, I just got the instant receipt for Move It, and we're still in the green.
So we can take that trip to Paris you promised me 20 years ago?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Move-In is a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending with no overdraft or ATM fees. You can even use it to pay a friend. Download the free app and get Move-In today.
Today, give your bank a call. Thank them for an account with a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a maximum number of account transfers per month and penalties for going above it. But most of all, thank them for all those overdraft fees and the fees you never knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the way you bank is about to change. Move-In is a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending with no overdraft or ATM fees. You can even use it to pay a friend. So make that call, say thanks, and get Move-In today.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Thanks to Liz crossing to us from London and giving us an update there. We've been talking to Andrew Winston, the author of The Big Pivot, and previously Green to Gold. And Andrew is an expert on all things in respect to energy. But to kick off this discussion today, I saw this fantastic quote from David Crane, who I understand Andrew works with. He's the president and CEO of NRG Energy. And he said, cutting down a pine tree, stripping off its arms, infusing it in tar, and then hanging a wire on it is the most environmentally sensitive and durable part of our electricity system in the United States? He said, and this was back in February at an energy conference, he said, just stop for a moment and think how shockingly stupid it is to build a 21st century electric system based on a system of 130 million wooden poles. So I've been really interested to, that's a great quote, really interested to see. There's a lot of talk about going off the grid right now, and you know, this sort of links to Elon Musk's you know, project at the moment to sort of reinvent battery production, not just for Tesla, but there seems to be this real renaissance, this real shift at the moment. This undeniable momentum, Andrew, in respect to this shift. That's exciting.
It is really exciting, and there's a word. I mean, there's distributed generation, as they call it, or DG. I mean, and I write a lot about and think a lot about resilience. And you know, you go back to Hurricane Sandy, kind of one of the biggest, most recent into climate and weather. You know, the electric grid got wet. One of the transponders for Con Edison, the utility, exploded in the city, and the lower half of Manhattan went dark for 4 days. So here's the financial capital of the world. Dark. And I, you know, call me crazy, but I think if your electric grid gets wet and it explodes, it's probably not very resilient. And so there's a deep logic. And actually, you mentioned NRG. They just purchased kind of a mobile power company. Like, they're kind of moving into this more resilience on the grid. I mean, a mix of things. And that's a much more resilient system, excuse me, than just having one big grid, as he said, with 140 million poles.
Mm. Absolutely. Just for those of you who have just joined us, we're talking to Andrew Winston, the author of The Big Pivot, subtitle which is Radically Practical Strategies for a Hotter, Scarcer, and More Open World. And as I'm looking at Amazon right now, his book is in the top 20 of green business books in the bestseller list on Amazon. So well done, Andrew, on that respect.
Thank you.
In fact, you've got some great praise for the new book, including a quote from David Crane. So you're doing some work with those guys, yeah?
Yeah, I've known them for a little while and have worked with them a little bit. And I think, you know, he's one of the forward-thinking utility CEOs that understands that there really is a deep change coming, and it's already here. I mean, we were talking, I guess, in the break that. You know, there's always this question of why aren't we moving faster on renewable or clean economy? And we are. I mean, you know, half or more of the energy being put on the grid globally is renewables. It is winning. Yeah. The economics are winning. It isn't just people wanting to hug trees or help the polar bears. It's just getting cheaper and cheaper. And so there's this kind of misperception for companies that it's just too expensive to put, you know, renewables up on their buildings. And it's just not true. It's gotten much cheaper over the last 3-4 years.
So this is, I mean, we see some economies right now. There's a lot of talk about Germany and Iceland and other economies like that who have made big moves in the renewables. And of course, that shift in Germany created some angst for the existing utility companies. And there's been some friction there. If you look at the United States in respect to this, you know, how far along on a global basis would you compare the United States in terms of their progress on this with other developed economies?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I mean, we've always, in the U.S., we've always been kind of a leader in innovation, and there's certainly new technologies and new startups in the clean economy that are based here, but the support from kind of government action, both, you know, a price on carbon would be really helpful here, or, you know, raising efficiency standards. Like, you know, we have an administration doing, I think, as much as they can, doing things like, you know, doubling the fuel economy of cars. I mean, that's effective. And there's new rules on coal and on carbon that are going to move us to cleaner fuels. But, you know, there's countries like Germany and China and others that have much more aggressive policies in place to build their renewable energy up. And there's a few different European countries that are, you know, moving much faster. I mean, Germany is one of the big ones. But again, there's kind of a business and a kind of geopolitical logic to all of this. I mean, Europe is, you know, relying on, for 1/3 of their coal and natural gas and oil, they rely on Putin and Russia. And it puts them in a really tough spot right now with everything going on in Ukraine. So Germany's goal to be renewable powered over the next generation is very smart, I think, geopolitically. It's very tough, because they're also trying to move away from nuclear at the same time. So that's been a real challenge. But I think they're going to get there before probably almost anybody else, and they'll be in a better position.
I'm very interested from the futurist perspective of how personally, you know, we become producers of energy as well. How do we get more independence from the grid?
Well, I think there's a couple. I mean, the obvious answer is that you make your own power, and then you also need to be able to store your own power, because if you're, you know, making power from the sun, obviously the sun goes down. And I think what's lacking so far, the technology that's missing or the gap that you've got lots of people chasing, and I think there will be tremendous innovation around, is storage, is how do we store that energy at the kind of household or small building level. I mean, there are some big storage projects out there on the grid that are working increasingly well, but there's still that gap. So I mean, right now, you know, I make over half the power I need in my own home from the solar panels we have, but that means during the day, during a sunny day like today, we're sending power back to the grid. So again, it's this kind of combination of being, you know, that there is a grid, there is a shared services, but there's this ability to kind of make your own. But I think increasingly you're going to see companies taking themselves off the grid as much as they can, and companies like Walmart are doing that in their stores. They're using solar, they're using fuel cells as a way to kind of get off the grid if they need to. If there's a storm, if there's, you know, the grid's down, it allows them to keep operating. That's just smart business, right? It's strong resilience.
Google was one of the first, wasn't it, to really, well, appeared to be. I mean, maybe they first got news about it, but traction from a news perspective. But they seem to be pretty early committed to self-powered technologies. Well,
right, and there's another kind of sector that at first it seems like, you know, like we talked about earlier about finance, that maybe it's not so heavy industry, but actually, and this is true for finance too, actually there's this huge base of energy being used in the background for all the data centers. And that's right. Another element of the financial world, the banks, that they don't really necessarily think about so much, that the cloud is not very light, actually. It's kind of heavy. It requires an enormous amount of energy, water, resources. And even though the technology is getting better and better and faster, we're capturing so much more data, right? I'm sure you've talked about big data on this program.
Sure.
It's outpacing even the kind of efficiency improvements. And so HP, you know, is a company that kind of did the calculations and said, you know, we're gonna need, you know, over the next few years, you know, something like 10 new power plants, and that's pretty hard to build just for the data centers. And so that means we need radical new solutions and new thinking about, you know, how available is the data or what technologies are we using. And so the tech companies are kind of pretty far ahead on this because they've realized that they have this huge risk and cost issue with energy. So Google, Facebook, Apple, I mean, they've moved pretty fast to renewables. Apple is about 100% renewable energy for all their data centers now. It's impressive how fast they've gone.
So, you know, what's the first thing that banks should be doing in respect to this? You know, where do we start?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, look, there's kind of two separate issues, as we said earlier. One is just operations. And sure, banks should be looking at their facilities and looking at renewables and looking at, you know, reducing their impacts and making their buildings green and all of that. And that's going on, and that's been going on for years. But second, I think it's really for the financial world to look very hard at how they're making investment decisions. I think there's a big gap on the Wall Street side of banks in particular with how they think about the investments they're making and the risks that they're facing. And they're not, you know, necessarily asking the tough questions of companies. There's a very big issue out there right now with something called stranded assets, which is the idea that we all have money invested in our pensions and our, you know, mutual funds, everything in the fossil fuel industry. And that if you believe, again, that we have this very big challenge in climate change, and that if you believe the science that we are going to be needing to cut carbon dramatically, then the fossil fuel companies are sitting on resources right now of way more fossil fuels than we could ever burn. And that means that according to, you know, Bloomberg New Energy Finance and other analyses, that they may be worth half as much or less than they are today. And they're going to be leaving these assets stranded. We basically have to leave a bunch of fossil fuels in the ground. And so I think there's this comeuppance, you know, happening. There's a bubble building, and you're seeing more and more kind of very serious bankers come to this conclusion. Former Treasury secretaries like Hank Paulson and Robert Rubin put out a report recently called Risky Business, and have written op-eds and said, we've got this carbon bubble building, and there's this huge bank of investment, you know, right? Hundreds of billions of dollars put into this industry, into assets that we can't use. So I think it's very dangerous for the investment community if they're not kind of on top of this.
So it's got to be a really balanced approach economically as well, because the potential for markets to be disrupted is significant as well.
Well, it's enormous. And I just think that, the investors that are looking at the fossil fuel industry in particular, it's not even just that they have assets already on the books. It's that they're spending hundreds of billions a year across the world seeking out new reserves of oil and gas, because the financial industry is, and Wall Street is always asking for, you know, reserve ratios.
Certainty,
reserve ratios. And it's a very dated view. Like, reserve ratios don't matter anymore.
Right.
We have enough in reserve to fuel ourselves for decades as we're moving away from fossil fuels. And so, you know, what really should be happening is the money should be flowing as fast as possible into the clean economy. And it's going pretty fast, but I think it needs to move in a much faster way and fund some of these new technologies and these, you know, the kind of gaps we have in things like storage and some transportation issues. You mentioned, you know, Elon Musk earlier. We need to, you know, ramp up the electrification of vehicles really fast.
Yeah.
And you know, and there's huge money to be made in all of this, right? Huge upside, trillions.
So this is interesting. I mean, one of the reasons we exist as a radio show is because of this explosion in venture capital around financial technology and this explosion of investment in new ways of doing this. Is there an equivalent industry growing in you know, this you know, renewable sustainability space?
Well, sure, and there's one that kind of, I think, crosses the strange Venn diagram of finance and energy. There's this move towards there's this model of providing energy called power purchasing agreements, which requires kind of financing and banks behind it. But what it means is you don't buy a solar panel for your roof; you lease the roof to somebody who's building the solar panels, and you just buy the power from them, and it's an asset. It's you sign a 15 or 20 year power purchasing agreement, and that's an asset that banks, you know, can own and can lend the money to the people needing the capital, the guys putting the solar panels up and buying them, right? And so there's this you know, great business model that's being built, and there's, you know, billions of dollars in these companies like SunEdison and Sungevity and Sunrun. They all have Sun in their name. It's, you know, maybe not the most clever branding, but, like, you know, these are fairly sizable businesses now, and there's banks behind them, you know, providing these assets. And what people don't realize, especially in the U.S., is that all the companies adding all of this renewable energy, they're almost always using this model. They're not actually putting their own capital out. So when a company's not putting capital out, you know there's capital somewhere. And where's that coming from? It's coming from these new funds. And so I have colleagues that are building, you know, very large funds to put into things like that, renewables, put into energy efficiency projects, anything where you can build this model of third-party financing where it's no money down. And it sounds like it's some gimmick or something, no money down, but it's a very, you know, very stable model, right? You know, and
it's an easy way for people to get into it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think there's increasing amount of money going into this as they realize the returns are kind of guaranteed. I mean, there's, you know, if you're giving someone a new energy efficiency technology, a new boiler or a solar panel on the roof, there's been this myth that renewables are somehow uncertain. Because there's something called intermittent power, meaning, you know, the sun goes down or the wind doesn't blow. So yeah, the power can come and go, but, like, the sun is not uncertain.
You know, it's absolutely.
We know it's coming up every day, and actually over the
it's
course of
like
a year,
it's not like we're going to use up all the light in the sun by capturing it on solar cells.
Right. Over the course of a year, we know how much sun hits a given spot. I mean, think about that as an asset. You know how much you're going to produce, and it's kind of like efficiency technologies are basically physics. Right, yeah. You know what the return's going to be. And so they're really great assets.
Absolutely. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes left. So, Andrew, just before we finish up, tell us about the big pivot and you know, what's in the book and how's it going for you?
It's going great, actually. I mean, you mentioned it's doing okay on Amazon. I don't know what the right channels are for selling books. I know you've had books as well. But it is selling very well. You know, companies buying it for their leadership teams or for groups of employees, and it's kind of happening in bulk quite a bit because I think it's a story that companies are finding compelling and important, which is that we have these really big challenges, and I lay those out pretty quickly in the book. We have a really volatile world of weather and in particular resource prices. I have this great data from McKinsey on how the price of everything has been going up over the last 10, 15 years and looks like it will indefinitely. And this is a big shift in the world. And so then I turn to, well, what do companies need to do to navigate this, to help bring about a kind of different world and to profit from it? And I have kind of three big buckets, and it's about changing our vision and how we see the world, changing valuation, meaning not values like ethics, but how do we value things? How do we put numbers on things that are hard to put numbers on? How do we make investment decisions? And then third, how do we partner differently with the government, with each other as businesses, and even with our own customers and consumers? And all of this kind of rolls up into this story of building resilience, building organizations that are flexible and more profitable and can handle the ups and downs of what is really a much more volatile world than we're used to. So that's the kind of the story. It's a pretty quick read, and I'm pretty happy with it, and I think the early readers have been pretty psyched about it. And I do think there's a lot for the financial and banking community to get from this about where the world's headed and what that means for where our money should be.
Great. So we've been talking to Andrew Winston. Thanks for joining us today, Andrew. We've been
talking
about his new book, The Big Pivot, available on Amazon. And where else can people find out information about you, Andrew?
Well, I'm at andrewwinston.com, two W's in the middle. It's pretty easy. And then, it's on Amazon. So it's kind of in stores.
Fantastic. So check out The Big Pivot. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you.
Great. We'll be right back after this short break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Today, give your bank a call. Thank them for an account with a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a maximum number of account transfers per month and penalties for going above it. But most of all, thank them for all those overdraft fees and the fees you never knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the way you bank is about to change. Moovin is a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending with no overdraft or ATM fees. You can even use it to pay a friend. So make that call, say thanks, and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Hey, honey, where are we going to eat tonight?
I don't know. Check Yelp for some place with good reviews.
Okay. Ooh, this place called Gabriel's looks nice. Authentic Italian cuisine sound good to you?
Yeah, sure, why not? Is it far?
Hold on, I'm checking. Looks pretty close, actually.
Let's just Uber it, then.
The chicken parm sounds great, but I've been trying to watch my weight.
I thought Luz had said you were on track to lose 5 pounds. I don't think one chicken parm is gonna hurt you. Anyway, after dinner, I thought we'd check out that new jazz club you've been wanting to go to.
Oh, I have a feeling that's far beyond our budget.
Actually, I just got the instant receipt for moving, and we're still in the green.
So we can take that trip to Paris you promised me 20 years ago?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Moovin is a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending with no overdraft or ATM fees. You can even use it to pay a friend. Download the free app and get moving today.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back to Breaking Banks. Thanks to Liz for that quick update from the Silicon Roundabout, as London FinTech is now being called. Silicon Valley, New York, Silicon Valley, California, Silicon Wadi in Israel, apparently. And then they got Silicon Roundabout and Silicon Castle in London and Edinburgh. Interesting. Okay, so let's cross to another international destination right now. We have Morten Creek from CIS Bankers. He's going to talk to us about what's happening in the Ukraine, how the crisis in Ukraine has affected people with their banking, and how it's affected the banks there. Over to you, Morten.
Thank you very much, Brett. I'm here with Robert Kossmann, Deputy Chairman of Raiffeisen Bank Aval. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Today we're going to discuss with you the current situation in Ukraine and how that is impacting the banking sector here in Ukraine. There's a lot going on here. Robert, you've been here for quite a while in Ukraine, and you have seen your fair share of adventure, I must say, as a banker. However, I don't know if it's been as challenging as this year. It all started off with Crimea. From what I've been told, the banks had to pull out there after the annexation. Banking became very difficult. In fact, it was made illegal by the Ukrainian government to perform any banking operations there. What's going on there?
Thanks for the question. It's always nice to let people know about the roller coaster ride that we have here in Ukraine in terms of the banking industry. Yes, unfortunately, in early February, the Russians annexed Crimea, and this had a direct impact on the financial institutions there. We, as Raiffeisen, were one of the largest institutions or banking institutions in Crimea. We had suffered a quite big loss as a result of the annexation. This is not unique only to us. All of the banks that were Ukrainian banks that were operating there have now since closed all their branches, closed all their offices, and are no longer legally, both from the Russian legal perspective and the Ukrainian legal environment, allowed to do business in Crimea. Of course, this has provided extreme complications on how we as Ukrainian banks repay our deposits, how we collect on our loans that we have. This is basically all thrown up in the air, and slowly but surely it's being sorted out in the way that the banks are having to write off these large portfolios of loans that they've extended over the years. And deposits are given back on a very, very stringent basis. This is not good for the Ukrainian banking industry as a whole, because currently any types of write-offs of these large scales has an impact on the capitalization of these banks. So we see it that we don't believe there's a way back, and this is a in-stone kind of situation. So all the banks are more or less licking their wounds and trying to move on from this traumatic event and putting it behind them, which is not an easy prospect for many of the big banks who had very large portfolios there, large corporate customers, lots of individuals, mortgages, car loans, credit cards. It's a very difficult situation.
Thank you, Robert. Putting it behind you, Crimea, is one thing, but then there is the next challenge waiting. And now, Robert, in the Donbas region, there's a whole different scenario than Crimea. People sense that in Crimea, everything happened overnight. Even the banks didn't see it coming. In the Donbas region, it's been there's a lot going on there for the past few months now, and banks probably should have more time to prepare for a worst case scenario. Are people right in expecting that banks will be better prepared for this or not?
I think there was a lot of lessons to be learned from the Crimean experience as Ukrainian bankers as a whole, and have never experienced some events as what is playing out today. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of similarities between, from a banking perspective, what has happened in Crimea and what is currently ongoing in Donetsk or Donbas. I make that reference because one was a quiet, very aggressive, hostile takeover with no bullets, very few lives taken. There was, at the end, banks from the Russian Federation who were ready to take over the assets. Here, it is not the case. There's a large war going on. You have displaced people. You have businesses that have been closed down. You have interruption of key vital services that keep people living and working on a daily basis. Of course, over the last few 4 or 5 months, this has played havoc for the banking system. Quite often during the last 4 or 5 months, we are opening branches in the morning, closing them in the afternoon, closing them for 2 weeks, opening them for 1 day. So the sporadic operations of our branches is dictated by the war that is going on. We, with all Ukrainian banks, are trying to maintain some level of operational services for our customers to keep the region going and whatever limited possibilities there are. Late in the game, meaning within the last 3 to 4 weeks, the National Bank and the government has quite strict in requesting banks or not allowing banks to operate in specific war zones or regions or cities. This means that there's no banking services, and so, rightfully so, because the war is quite intense in these specific areas. In terms of what is playing out for the banks, this region as a whole, depending on statistics, whatever statistics you look at, accounts for 15 to 20% of GDP of Ukraine historically. It has approximately 2.5 million inhabitants, and therefore to have this type of indicators means that there was intense activity for the last 5 to 10 years in developing these two regions, in lending to these regions, all the way from corporate entity, international entities, down to mass customers. This does not play well when you're in a war environment and asking customers to repay their loans, both from the corporate perspective and from the retail perspective. Customers are displaced, without jobs, working in other regions, have migrated to other regions. Lack of ability, no branches open, inhibits customers to have some payment discipline. So this is starting to play out as a negative direction for banks, meaning that portfolios day by day are getting worse and worse.
All right. Now, I also want to take a look at the Russian banks in the country, Robert. At the start of the summer, there was a lot of aggression towards Russian banks. We saw them being attacked, looted, vandalized. That storm seems to have blown over now. If you look at the Russian banks today in Ukraine, except for Alpha Bank, most of the large Russian banks here are state-owned banks. It seems that they are well supported by their shareholders to prevent their clients from defaulting. Is there a possibility that they can avoid taking the big hits that you're all in line for, or is that unlikely?
I think it's the situation for the Russian-owned banks that operate here, and there's 4 or 5 of them, it's extremely difficult, much more than the Ukrainian or international. In the fact that, of course, the negative perception of the ongoing war does not contribute to a positive perception of them. You have the mandated stress tests that were a part of the IMF agreement, which looked at the top 25 or 30 banks did stress tests of these. And every bank, including the Russian banks, will have an impact of this, meaning that shareholders will need and will be required to continue banking in Ukraine to provide additional capital. So this is another factor that will play into consideration by the Russian shareholders. I would say that the impact on the financial situation is not only being impacted by the Russian banks. I think across the board, the top 30 to 40 banks, what we see in the numbers is that everyone is suffering. Year-to-date numbers for deposit outflows for the system as a whole is around minus 27% of total foreign currency deposits. That's dollar deposits and euro deposits, minus 27%. For local currency, hryvnia deposits, it's minus 14%. So these two combined show you that the stress on the system of deposit withdrawals is quite substantial. There's very few economies in the world that could withstand such a type of withdrawal of deposits from the system without suffering some type of, I wouldn't say catastrophic, but extreme stress on the system. And that's what we see today. You compound that with the devaluation from the beginning of the year of around 50%, and throw in the war. You can see that these three factors combine to put the financial system under extreme stress. And I always refer to, there's not very many developing economies that could suffer these three strong impacts at the same time and not suffer through difficult times.
Now, one of the leading banking portals here in the country, they showed some growth statistics for the Ukrainian state-owned banks. Could that also be explained with a growing sentiment towards their own national banks here?
I believe that's based on my experience over the many years I'm here, is that in any type of crisis, and there are many to look back upon, you always see a flight to quality. Historically, in the 2008-2009 crisis, the flight to quality was primarily to Western-owned banks. And at that time, there were quite a few of them that had presence here. Now, when we look at the crisis today, we see not so many Western banks remaining. So the flight to quality is a combination of Western banks and the very large state-owned banks, because of the implicit guarantee that's certain level of deposits is protected by the state. But this is kind of a misguidance, because if you look at the financial situation of the country as a whole, the fiscal situation, you would not consider this to be a strong guarantee of. So every bank operates under the state deposits guarantee system. So I think that's, of course, the state bank owned banks do see an impact, or we do see an impact. It's limited in nature, and I think that what we are feeling is a universal, across the board, large bank deterioration.
All right. Now, one last question for you. Last year, we invited Brett to the CIS Bankers Conference here, and we discussed the future of banking. And we remember your passionate statements on the necessity of branches here in Ukraine. How does the current situation in Ukraine influence the development of the digital channels here, according to you?
Yeah, I duly remember this discussion we have, and it was quite eye-opening in 1 year ago when things were dramatically different. If you had asked me the same question 1 year ago, I would say that the digital movement or the migration to digital, both from a consumer point of view and from the financial institution's viewpoint, was accelerating at that time. 1 year later, with the current situation that we're under, digital investment from a financial perspective is slowed down considerably. So I think that all the banks have many other issues that they're looking at in terms of capitalization, liquidity, and digitalization, moving their digital strategy to the future is at the moment put on the back burner. But we all hope that in the near future, if things turn around, that banks will then become again more active in pursuing the digital strategies that we all envision us to do over the next 3 to 5 years.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Robert Kosman. As you can hear, banking in Ukraine is never boring. Back to you, Brett.
Thanks, Martin. Appreciate the update. Very interesting. You know, sometimes we forget the human element of these stories, so it's good to hear some updates from there. Just to wrap up quickly before the end of the show, we have a great show for you guys next week, including we're going to have Michael Panovich from mBank in Poland, a pure play, well, it's sort of a digital rebranded bank from Poland. And Poland's interesting market has either the highest or the second highest contactless penetration in the world right now. So stay tuned for that show next week. Coming up the week after that, we have a really incredible show on machine intelligence, artificial intelligence. So stay with us on Breaking Banks over the next few weeks. It will be worth it. Thanks for joining us again. I'm Brett King, your host. I'll see you next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.